listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, I've been rolling this around. I see this in my own family. I know so many people, some of the younger people who work, you know, with us and for us. This is and it hit me today. I mean, I've kind of said this before, but it just really hit me hard today about student debt. That literally never in the history of the developed world, never before, never in the United States, not in any other developed nation, never in the history of the developed world has an entire generation had to go into debt just to get an education and thus get a job. Until now. Back in January, 31-year-old Tony Muzzotti, who at the time owed around $60,000 in student loan debt to Sallie Mae, always made his payments on time, was told that he had to immediately make a payment of $10,000 or face asset seizures. Why? Well, because his grandmother, who was the co-signer on his student loans, just died. Christopher Kibler was told by Sallie Mae that he had to immediately pay back nearly $22,000 in student loan debts after his father, the co-signer on his loans, had passed away. I'm the co-signer on one of my kids' student loans. God forbid, you know. Muzzotti and Kibler are just two of the many victims of what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau refers to as auto defaults, when banks immediately say that private student loan debts are in default because of the death or bankruptcy of a cosigner. This auto default practice is just one of the many ways that big banks and Wall Street executives are making billions of dollars off an entire generation of struggling debt-ridden Americans. We have $1.18 trillion in outstanding student loan debt in the United States. We've never, ever had anything even remotely close to this. There are more than 40 million Americans with student loan debt. 40 million. That's more than the entire population of Canada, Poland, North Korea, Australia, and more than 200 other countries. I didn't know there were 200 countries. It's only 197, I guess there must be. And of those 40 million borrowers, almost 7 million have already defaulted on their debt. I mean, this is how bad it's gotten. The average 25-year-old American who has student debt, the average debt that that kid is holding has risen, kid, 25, whatever, has risen 91% just in the last 10 years. Average college debt per person is over $23,000. And the result of this is that an entire generation of Americans is completely screwed. They can't start a family. They can't buy a house. And if you don't, you know, I mean, typically people who are retiring in their 60s, the equity that they have, I mean, this is where most American household equity exists. The equity that they have is in their homes. And the way that you get to the point where you've got enough equity that, you know, you've got a home that's worth, when you retire, maybe borrowing against or selling or, you know, whatever, you know, some equity, is you buy it. You buy your first house in your 20s. And then over the next 40 years, as you're making payments, you eventually pay it off. Or you pay, you know, you keep moving up in housing, and each step along the way, you get a little more equity, and you roll it into the next house, and you roll it into the next house. And we actually subsidize this with our tax code. But now we have an entire generation of Americans. I mean, literally an entire generation of Americans. People typically younger than 30 years old, many of them, you know, most of them under 25 years old, who don't have the ability to build that kind of equity. And don't have the ability to build that kind of equity because they're, you know, They can't take on a $70,000 mortgage because they've got $30,000 in student debts. I mean, the national average is in the high 20s, like 27,000 or something. This is a morally criminal conspiracy that's been going on for the past 33 years, ever since Ronald Reagan came to Washington, and it's been a three-step process. First, as governor of California, Reagan did away with that state's free college education program that had let tens of thousands of Californians get an affordable and quality education. Others across the country followed his lead. As soon as he came to Washington, Reagan continued this all-out assault on affordable college education by slashing federal aid to higher education institutions across the country, including America's land-grant colleges that have been providing affordable and quality education since they were first established by Abraham Lincoln, the Morrill Act, 1862. When Reagan came into office, only about 20% of the cost of tuition was cost of going to college was paid as tuition by the student. The other 80% was paid by governments and endowments. Today, it's the exact reverse. So all these students are in debt. We've got an entire generation that can't afford to start a house, can't afford to start a family, can't afford to buy a house, can't afford to, by the time they're 50, 60, they're not going to have the equity to retire that the generations before them had. No other industrialized country in the world has indebted an entire generation just for student loan debts. Next, Reagan laid the groundwork for the federal government to get involved in student loan business. And thanks to his new ed policies and putting Bill Bennett in as his hostile to education secretary of labor, federal government has had an incentive to hand out loans to hundreds of thousands of students because of interest on those loans. It'll be government revenue. This was the whole Reagan thing. And finally, our backwards trade policies that have been in place for the last 33 years have also devastated America's lost generation. Believe it or not, there used to be a time in this country when you could graduate from high school, get a good-paying blue-collar job, and provide for your family and save for your retirement. But thanks to decades of job-killing trade policies, that's no longer the case. Now, in order to become part of the middle class, to have any kind of a shot at the American dream, you have to go to college, which means that you have to strap yourself with thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars in student loan debt to get that degree and get that white-collar job. So forget about getting married and getting a house and starting to build the kind of equity that you'll be able to retire with when you're in your 60s. And the worst part of all this is that we Americans, uniquely, I mean, we're the only country in the world that has this problem. We have done this to ourselves. We shot ourselves in the foot by listening 33 years ago to Ronald Reagan, by buying this whole Reaganomics idea that education should be a commodity and something that somebody can make a buck off of, instead of thinking that education is part of the commons. We need to own up to our own mistakes. We need to start calling America's student loan debt crisis what it really is, a massive, devastating, trillion-dollar, morally criminal conspiracy committed by Wall Street bankers, libertarian billionaires, and Reaganomics devotees. And then maybe we can undo some of the damage to an entire generation. We should declare a debt jubilee on all outstanding student loan debt in America. Just wipe the slate clean. They shouldn't have had to go to debt in the first place. Abraham Lincoln started the nationwide free schools. Thomas Jefferson, on his tombstone, he said it was more important to put on his tombstone that he started the University of Virginia, which was America's first free college, than that he was president of the United States. And his tombstone, which he designed, says he was the author of the Virginia Declaration of Religious Freedom, the Declaration of Independence, and the founder of the University of Virginia. Free college has been part of America's tradition literally since the Jefferson presidency, and Ronald Reagan started taking it apart. We need to relieve millions of Americans from this crippling debt so that they can begin building, starting families, invest in their homes, start building equity. We need to make a public college education free to every American who qualifies for it. You know, that would cost us less over the next decade than just the Iraq War has cost us. It is insane where our priorities are. Well, Senator Sanders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bernie has some thoughts on where we're at with carbon in the air. This is going to be interesting. Stick around. The Tom Hartman Program, a place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Senator Bernie Sanders in the studio live with us. Senator Sanders, great to have you with us. Great to see you.
Great to be here with you, Tom.
Thank you so much. I wanted to ask you your thoughts, and I know, I believe that you and Barbara Boxer worked on this, on legislation, about putting a price on carbon. How do we do that? Why do we need to do that?
Well, the why is obvious. The scientific community is very, very clear that climate change is real. Climate change is caused by human activity. Climate change is already causing devastating problems in our country and around the world. And what the scientists tell us very alarmingly, if we do not get our act together, if we do not transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, the future of this planet for our kids and grandchildren and great-grandchildren is very dubious. So clearly we have to act, and we have to act in a bold way. One of the immediate actions that has to be taken is a tax on carbon, and Senator Boxer and I have introduced legislation to do just that. It would be $20 per ton of carbon. That amount would go up about 5.5% a year. We are going to do it in a way that impacts fewer than 3,000 of the most significant fossil fuel polluters in the country. And the reason you do it is people should not have the freedom, quote unquote, to destroy the planet. They should not have the freedom to produce an enormous amount of carbon dioxide, which results in warming the planet, which results in massive devastation throughout our country and the world. They cannot continue to be able to do that with impunity. And this is one important vehicle. The other mechanism that we need, of course, is as we transform our energy system, we have got to focus on energy efficiency and weatherization. We have the technology to do huge things in that way. And by the way, Tom, when you do that, not only do you cut carbon emissions, you also save people money on their fuel bills. And you know what else you do? You create millions of jobs. And the other thing we have to do is develop and increase our utilization of such sustainable energies as wind, solar, geothermal, biomass. We are making progress. But given the severity of the problem right now, we're not moving fast enough. So we are looking at a fight to save this planet. And we have got to be bold. We have got to be aggressive. Last point that I want to make. You know, you and I know a whole lot of people have different points of view. That's what we do. And that's called democracy, and that's fine. But I find it really frightening that we have a major political party in this country today that has rejected the science, the overwhelming science regarding climate change. Now, these guys don't tell you that they're objecting to research in cancer, research in heart disease, but somehow or another, when there is research which offends the fossil fuel industry and big oil and big coal and the Koch brothers, people who, among other things, put huge amounts of money into campaigns and political donations, somehow they reject that science. And that is very, very frightening. And the American people have got to rise up and say, hey, we can disagree about this, we can disagree about that. But if our public policy is not based on science, then what does it mean?
What are your thoughts? Carbon tax is just a straight carbon tax. What are your thoughts on this fee and rebate program? It's sort of modeled after the Alaska Permanent Fund, I guess, where there's a fee, but all of the money that comes in actually goes back to the people.
Well, it's not all. I mean, in our legislation, we have a substantial amount of money that goes into weatherization. There, we are wasting billions and billions of dollars just in having energy going through our walls and our roofs. We want to deal with that. We want to invest in new technology for solar, wind, geothermal, and biomass. But significantly in this legislation, a very large sum goes back directly to people who may have to pay short-term, at least, higher fuel bills. So we are protecting those people who might be hurt. We are encouraging, in a significant way, the solar, wind industry, geothermal industry, to become more productive, to lower their prices. And we're going to make sure that millions of people can cut the energy that they utilize.
That's marvelous. What's your sense of where Congress is at on this?
Well, again, you have a Republican Party that is, you know, look, I disagree with Republicans on almost every issue. But on this issue, to reject science is incomprehensible. Look, if the Republicans gain control over the Senate, do you know who the new chairman of the Environmental Committee will be? The gentleman who will have oversight dealing with climate change? It'll be Jim Inhofe. And Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma wrote a book. I think it's called The Hoax, The Great Hoax, something like that. He believes that climate change is a hoax. perpetrated by Al Gore, the United Nations, and Hollywood. I think those are the perpetrators. He is going to be the gentleman chairing the Environmental Committee if Republicans gain control of the Senate. So that's where we are with those guys. On the other hand, what I can tell you is that among the American people, more and more see with their own eyes what's happening in their communities. You know, people used to go ice fishing, can't go ice fishing anymore. People who used to go catch fish, professional commercial fishermen, seeing what's happening to the fishing stock. People can see what's happening to the glaciers all over the world. So more and more people see the damage, and especially young people are demanding action. So the momentum is clearly with us, and we've just got to stick it to these guys and make sure that they address the scientific realities of the day.
In the final minute we have, do you think there's any hope for things being done at the state level?
States, look, when you have a Congress which is dysfunctional, when you have a Republican Party that tries to obstruct every significant piece of legislation, we are left with the states being bold and aggressive. And I can tell you that in Vermont, we are moving not as aggressively as I want, but pretty strongly in terms of weatherizing many, many, many thousands of homes. We are moving into solar in a big way, wind, geothermal, but we need to do more. Look, there is the scientific community, people who know most about us, telling us that we are in a crisis situation. And what's at stake is nothing less than the planet we're going to leave our kids and our grandchildren. So we have got to be incredibly bold, and I'm going to fight to make sure that happens.
Good on you. Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us here.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We will be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We will be back with I got a variety of rants for you here today. Just stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Say what? Oh, we'll be right back with more. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So I've got this very simple plan to stop our students from being indentured servants, basically, to the banksters. And it's number one, declare a debt jubilee. Just wipe, you know, student loan debt never should have happened in the first place. We should look at it, you know, the way that we looked at slavery and say, oops, shouldn't have done that. And, you know, we're going to wipe it off the books now. Just take it off the table. No more student loan debt. Number one. Number two, we should say, going forward, we're going to do what every other developed country in the world does, which is we're going to invest in our intellectual infrastructure and our future. You shouldn't have to go bankrupt. You shouldn't have to go $27,000 average in debt just to be able to get a job. And even then, half the time, these people can't get a job. So anyhow, and then number three, we need to go back to what Abraham Lincoln started, the land-grant colleges, basically free or so cheap that, like my mom, who worked her way through Michigan State University and actually got her degrees, either Sigma or Magna Cum Laude, I can't remember which one of those is higher, but she got the top one. She got her degree in English, so all my life, I got this, and she's like, Goddess! German for God. You mean I have this? It's like this is what I grew up with. She was wonderful, actually. But she worked her way through Michigan State University. She had no money. I mean, she told me stories about, you know, they would squeeze the toothpaste tube in the door jamb to get the last of the toothpaste out. They were living on a budget. But she worked her way through Michigan State University working in the summer, during the summer break, as a lifeguard in Charlevoix, Michigan, which is where she was from. And then on weekends throughout the college year, she'd go out to the Lansing Airport and wash airplanes and prop airplanes, start them up back in those days. I mean, this was back in the 40s. You had to spin the propeller to start the plane. And she went to college doing that. My dad went to college for free on the GI Bill. They paid him to go to college. He didn't finish like my mom did because she got pregnant with me. And she was 2 years older than he was. But, you know, it's like we need to go back to that and say that's the way it should be. So we got that. We got global warming deniers. I find them insane. Laurel in Adrian, Minnesota, you have some thoughts on global warming deniers. You want to share that with
yes,
us?
Yes, yeah. And first off, before I get to that point on taking over the midday, I'm taking over the midday slot. I wish Ed Schultz the best on his new endeavor. I really want him to succeed on what he does. And I've listened to him longer than I've listened to you, to be honest with you. No offense intended. And I really do wish him the best. Another point, as far as getting the tube of toothpaste out of the getting the toothpaste out of the tube. I have an uncle that passed away about 20, 25 years or so ago. Actually patented a machine that could get
the last of the toothpaste out. Oh, that's great.
I wish I had one of those contraptions on me right now. You know, I could describe how it works. I haven't seen one of those again, you know, since he died. But,
yeah.
You know, getting back to my original point, you know, listening to Bernie Sanders talking about global warming and in regards to how the public perceives the sciences to that, you know, and I don't know if it was the penny dropping in my mind or my stomach just dropping in my gut that made me realize, you know, oh, my God, why is it that when somebody on the right talks about global warming is a hoax, there is no such thing as climate change, why is it that nobody in the media is questioning to them, well, if the science for climate change isn't that sound, then are you comfortable willing to deny that microorganisms cause disease? Are you willing to deny that drunk driving leads to more deaths on the road? Are you willing to deny that smoking cigarettes causes cancer?
Well, this is, Laurel, last night I was having this debate with a couple of conservatives on the TV, and Kevin Martin was one of them, and I'm not picking on him, you know, he's not here to defend himself, but this is just what was said. I said to him, do you think that the Earth is the center of the universe? I mean, there's a group of people who believe this. In fact, you know, some Hollywood starlet or star just got sucked into making a movie or voicing a movie, you know, by accident about that very thing. And the question, you know, I said, do you think that the Earth is the center of the universe, that the sun revolves around the Earth? And Kevin was like, no. And I said, how do you know that? I mean, it looks like the sun goes around the Earth. How do you know that? And he was like, well, you know, scientists tell us. I'm like, oh, so you listen to scientists when I, you know, yeah. So that's how I would respond, Laurel. And I think you make a great point. Thank you very much for the call and for your kind words for everybody here. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Just great.
About the global warming, you know, there's a lot of people that deny it, and there's a lot of people who want to debate it. But, you know, and we have a record of cutting back emissions and expanding resources is great. And while we've done this, we've still vastly increased our exports of dirty energy, especially like pet coke,
yep,
to countries that have far less regulations than we do. And, you know, this is a global problem. You know, the atmosphere has no boundaries.
Yeah.
The point is we have to work towards keeping more of it in the ground. And I know you've talked about bringing back manufacturing to the United States. The dilemma is that it's going to take energy, and which is mostly still supplied by carbon fuels.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is
it consumes far more than any country in the world. And the idea of unlimited growth and more consumption of stuff we really don't need, it just doesn't have a happy ending.
Well, I don't disagree, but I think that if we were to bring back manufacturing in the United States, a number of things could happen. Number one, we have more than enough solar and wind power in this country to power an industrial, you know, machine, as it were, okay, to power industry. I mean, we are awash in sunlight, particularly the southern half of this country. But even the north, I mean, you know, Germany is the cloudiest country in Europe, and it's at a latitude that's, you know, roughly, it's actually a little bit north of Michigan. So, and they had a day last week where 74% of all the electricity in the country came from solar power. And it's just because about a third of the households in Germany have solar panels that occupy less than half of their roofs. Can you imagine if we said we're going to make every roof in America a solar collector? I mean, boom, overnight. And the technology's there, and it's not expensive. As the Germans have demonstrated. So, A, we could do that. And B, You know, industry does not have to be smelly and dirty. This is one of the things that, for example, the Tesla factory, which is here in the United States making cars, has demonstrated. You can do it in an energy efficient way. And see, I mean, you know, what's happening is China is making junk for us, disposable stuff. Now, when your toaster breaks, you throw it away. When your TV breaks, you throw it away. When, you know, your radio breaks, you throw it away. If fill in the blanks. Your refrigerator breaks, your dishwasher. I mean, occasionally, I guess there's still repair people for some of these appliances. But by and large, when things break, we throw them away because they're disposable, because they're made as junk in China or Vietnam or Mexico or whatever, so that we can get cheap prices. If we were to bring manufacturing back to the United States, we could bring back the repair industry as well, and we could start making things that last for 20 years instead of last for 3 years. No more planned obsolescence. No more junk. We could actually make good stuff here. And that is very energy efficient.
I totally agree with you there. And
I'm listening.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay. And that actually, I think, would be a, you know, we could dramatically decrease the world's production of carbon-based pollution, carbon dioxide pollution, and other, you know, greenhouse gases as a consequence of manufacturing, simply by bringing it back home and doing it the way that we in America know how to do it, like Tesla's doing, and like some of the high-tech manufacturing around San Francisco is being done. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, got a minute to the break. It's yours. What's up? Charles? Charles is not there. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Yours, Randy. What's up?
I'll get to the point quick. What I wanted to comment on is on carbon fuel usage in the past 5 years. The Obama administration has stated that due to conservation, America is using less energy than it had been.
Right.
And I don't think that they're being 100% honest. I think that if you take the 60,000 factories and the tens of millions of jobs that went overseas, I think that that is the reason that the energy use in America is down for the
last. There's no doubt in my mind, Randy, that to some extent you're right. I think, though, that the major thing is that the price of gasoline and oil have gone up so dramatically over the last two decades, and that is causing companies to figure out ways to be more efficient. You know, Walmart. I mean, the president showed up at a Walmart 2 weeks ago to congratulate, which I thought was a mistake, but nonetheless, he did it. He showed up at a Walmart to congratulate that company on becoming one of the greenest companies in America. Well, they're saving energy, not because they give a rat's ass about the future of the planet, but because they want to save money. So I think that that's happening, too. But you make a good point, Randy. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Any other ideas, by the way, on your part about how we can solve $1.18 trillion student loan crisis? And welcome back. Oh, this right here?
Okay, sure. Yeah.
We're trying something new on the TV show. So if you're on Skype and want to ask me a question or comment, Skype us from 3:30 to, right now, between 3:30 and 4:30 today. And our producers, Andrew and Nate, will record you and will air the videos on tonight's Your Take, My Take Live. All right. So if you have Skype and you want to ask a question live, it won't be live, but if you want to have your question recorded so for us to answer on the air tonight on the TV show on The Big Picture, Skype us to Talk to Tom. That's TalkToThom. And Jim, maybe you can make a lower third for that for future reference. TalkToThom. That's our Skype ID. So with that having been said, Richard in Bradley, Illinois, watching us on Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I have a couple comments and maybe a question you can answer for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a veteran of the Army.
Right.
And I've been going to the VA hospital for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some pretty bad diagnosis on certain things. And to this date, I have lost my job. I cannot go back to work. I have not been released to go back to work by my VA doctors.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, nothing has been done by the VA doctors to rectify any problems of mine. And I cannot get any assistance. I've lost my apartment. I've lost everything I own, and I've worked hard for the last 40 years.
Yeah. I would submit, Richard, let me give you a macro answer and a micro answer, okay? A big picture answer and a specifically to you answer. The big picture answer is the you and a lot of other veterans, apparently several hundred thousand veterans, are caught in this in the crossfire of a battle that's been going on for roughly 30 years here in the United States between conservatives who think that it should not be the business of government to provide health care, even to our veterans, that it should all be privatized. And therefore, you've seen, you know, 9 major pieces of legislation proposed by Democrats, and including a $31 billion expansion of funding for the VA so that they could see people like you more easily and more quickly, been filibustered by Republicans in the Senate. Every single one of these. Not a single piece of legislation to help veterans has passed a Republican filibuster since Barack Obama became president. And they're hoping that you will blame Obama for this. Okay? So you're caught in the middle of that crossfire. And it really goes all the way back to the Reagan administration. But the second thing is, I'm wondering if you have called the local office of either your member of the House of Representatives or either of your 2 senators and asked for their the person who does, what's it called?
For their assistance.
Yeah, there's a particular name for the office. It's escaping. Constituent Services. Thank you, Shana.
I have contacted my local VA officer.
No, you want to talk to your representative, your member of the House of Representatives, and ask for Constituent Services. And they've got a guy on their staff or a woman on their staff. Actually, they've got several people on their staff whose entire job is to hear from people like you with specific complaints about government agencies and then go raise hell at that government agency. And they will do it on your behalf if they're any good at all. And you've got a couple of good senators there in Illinois, and I don't know who represents you in the House of Representatives, but you need to find out and to start with your House members, because they represent a smaller number of people, so they have more bandwidth for this kind of stuff. So, Richard, I wish you the very best. I'm sorry to hear your story. Thank you for calling. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul in near Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Paul.
Did you know that there's an energy source that hasn't been tapped yet that could turn a generator?
And that is?
It's clean gravity. Picture this, Tom.
Oh, gravity's already been tapped. We call them dams and water power. I mean, hydropower. That's gravity pulling water down.
Okay. Now, picture this. Picture a generator large enough to power a house.
Right.
Take a rock, tie it to a string, wrap the other end of the string around the shaft that turns the generator, take the other end of the rock, tie it over a tree limb. As the rock falls, you have generator motion.
Right. Are you familiar with Newton's first law of motion?
Yes.
Okay. So once that rock hits the ground, it has expended all of the energy represented, the potential energy has become kinetic energy, all that energy represented in the difference of distance between the tree branch and the ground, that has all been expended. And an equal amount of energy is going to have to be applied to that rock to lift it back up to the level of the tree limb so it can spin that generator again. And that amount of energy is going to be greater than the amount of energy that you're going to get out of the generator from the first time it fell, because generators have losses. There's no loss-free generation system. And even if it was identical, all it could do is lift the rock, you know, all it could do is just run itself forever. But it's not even, there's always losses. So,
there is losses. But what you have is a gear train that essentially slows down the rate of the fall of the weight.
Right.
And then you have.
But how much energy is it going to take you to put that rock over that branch in the first place?
Okay.
Let's say it takes 100 watts of energy to lift that rock up to that branch, which would be, you know, like, you know, 10 guys spending an hour lifting this thing. So you got a giant rock, you know, 100, and it's going to generate 100 watts of energy. The rock comes down, it generates 100 watts of electricity. It puts 100 watts of power into a generator. The generator will put out probably 60 or 70 watts of electricity, because I think most modern generators are around 60 or 70% efficient. And right. Now you've got to expend another 100 watts to lift that rock back up. I don't get it.
Okay, now I've only worked this out on paper, but I'm anxious to get this idea in the hands of a mechanical engineer and an electrical engineer.
Well, I can tell you, as a almost an electrical engineer, I've majored in electrical engineering before okay. I dropped out of college. I used to own a TV repair shop. I'm a licensed ham radio operator. I used to be a licensed broadcast engineer. I was an engineer for RCA, in fact, for a year. That's how I paid for that's how I got insurance for our first child. I have some familiarity with basic electronics and basic physics, and I can still remember Ohm's law, you know, E equals IR, I equals R over E over R, R equals
right.
E over
okay.
I. That what you're describing is perpetual motion or you know, the...
Oh, no, it's in no way perpetual motion, but, all right, now picture...
Gravity is a one-way thing. If you could figure out a way to turn off gravity while you're lifting that rock back up, and there are actually people working on that, is there a way to block gravity? If you could block gravity less than 100 watts.
Machine.
Pardon?
You would have to reset the machine. There's no doubt about it. This is not a perfect system. But, for example, if you were to take the weights, slice them up into small things, climb a ladder, reset the whole thing, and then let it drop again, and then create a period where the generator runs for maybe 2 weeks or something like that by using a tower to make the period of the fall.
Yeah. You want to do it a really simple way, Paul? Put a windmill on top of your house and run the string around the windmill and let the wind pull the string and pull the rock up. And then, you know, flip a lever that loosens what are those gear things called? Like a clutch, basically,
right,
so that the string can drop back down and the kinetic energy can go into the converter, and then use wind power to lift the rock back up again. But now you're not producing electricity. I mean, you're using gravity, and like I said, I mean, you know, wind power has to do with gravity. It has to do with the rotation of the Earth around the sun. And,
right.
and, you know, which in part has to do with the gravitational force of the sun on the Earth. And water power has to do with the gravitational force of the Earth's gravity on water. And very, very slightly, like 1/10,000,000 of 1%, the gravitational force of water on the Earth. But it ain't gonna work. I mean, you're arguing with Isaac Newton. Paul, I got to move along, but I wish you the best with it. And if you can come up with a better version on it, I'd love to hear it. Charles Nopalaka, Florida, you had a comment on the global warming deniers?
Okay, good. Hi. How you doing, Tom?
Good. Hey, Charles.
Okay, great. I just wanted to expand on what I was talking about yesterday.
Yeah.
Because basically I feel like, you know, if, as Americans, you know, what do we say about a George Bush administration? You know, actually showing us out. And he sold us out in so many ways. First of all, with the global climate, these climate deniers, you don't have to look at it as just a climate issue, but I think it's more of a, you know, profit issue. The other day I was watching my local PBS station, and on the nightly business report, they were saying that stocks for coal has risen and people are making great dividends off the coal.
Right.
Especially when you have trains that's at least 2 miles long, and they're pushing out coal 24/7.
Yep.
You know that. You know, so where somebody else is going through a lot of misery, as far as the climate changing and you know bad weather, where you have other people that's making money, that's looking at it.
Yeah, and they're doing the same thing with gas, oil, and gas and oil, I guess. Yeah.
Exactly. And the last thing is today I'm finding out that we have a new trade deal that was proposed between us and the Euro nations.
Yeah,
and that trade deal that we're giving away so much, was like I said, you know, how much did George Bush and his administration sell out America? Where you know you have European countries actually thinking, well, you know, they'll do all the damage in America, forget their wind and solar power that they're using in Europe. I mean,
yeah, no, it's another, we need Ross Perot back. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. It's another bizarre trade deal that the Obama administration is pushing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Raise the issue of reparations, and all sorts of interesting things happen. Which is why John Conyers proposed House Resolution 40, and has for years, actually, H.R. 40, which would simply establish a commission to study reparation proposals. The value of slaves in the United States at the beginning of the Civil War, the value of just the slaves, market value, was greater than the value of all other combined assets in this country. They were the principal industrial asset. You walk around Washington, D.C., you walk through the Capitol, it was built by slaves. Walk through the White House, it was built by slaves. I walk through this city, and I'm constantly walking. I'm walking on streets that were originally paved by slaves. Slave labor built this country for hundreds of years. It's like we ran up this huge credit card bill. We tore families apart. We devastated a culture. We tore communities apart. And then when we ended slavery, we said, yeah, you're free, but, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson, but, you know, you're going to have to stay over there. And down in the South, between the ongoing activities of the Ku Klux Klan, you know, the famous quote, you know, what's the best way to stop a black man they used a much less friendly word, from voting is get to him the day before the election. Lynchings, beatings, the Literacy Act, the literacy tests that were widespread across the South, where if you were white, they'd show up and say, spell blue. And if you were black and showed up, they'd say, please recite the Declaration of Independence, word for word. One word wrong, you can't vote. And we did this up until the 1960s. And then we started redlining. Actually, the banks have been doing it for some time, but they legally did that up until the late 1970s, where if you lived in a black neighborhood, you couldn't get a mortgage. And you had to go with these loan sharks who became multimillionaires, quote, leasing their houses when they thought they were buying them. So it's like we've run up this giant credit card bill, we being white America or educated America or middle class America, including some African Americans who have been able to make it, in spite of all that, and God bless them, there's a growing black middle class in America. We've run up this giant credit card bill. What do we do about it? Now, I don't have any kind of answer about reparations, but I do think that John Conyers' H.R. 40, the Commission to Study Reparations Proposals for African Americans Act, is an interesting start. Michael Massey is a conservative commentator, former chairman of the Project 21 group, the website nationalcenter.org/p21index.html. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. I'm also the I'm not affiliated as such with Project 21. I am with, however, I do publish the very popular blog, The Daily Rant, michael-massey.com.
Okay.
And that is what I'm doing these days, including waiting for my new book to come out.
Okay.
So I just wanted to get that all clear.
Please, please thank you for that. And let's it's michael-massey, M-A-S-S-I-E.com.
That's correct. And Michael is M-Y-C-H-A-L, M-A-S-S-I-E.com.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Although I'm guessing probably if somebody plugs your name into a search engine, even if they misspell it, they will find you.
They'll find me, and if they don't, they can just plug in the Daily Rant, and you'll see close to 100 million hits on that. So.
Okay, so everything that I just said, and you're African-American, and I'm not.
Actually, I'm not African-American. I'm an American. There's my family isn't from Africa. We can trace our roots, our modern roots, and I'm fourth generation removed from slavery. Mm. And at that point, the Caribbean blood in my ancestry was being weaned out. As a matter of fact, I'm the first of my generation that was unable to speak fluent Pennsylvania Dutch because my family was predominantly Pennsylvania Dutch and Native American or Indian, various Indian.
Yeah.
Coming out of the Carter plantation of the 1700s at Front Royal, Virginia. So I think I know a little bit about slavery. I think I know a little bit about what black people have, black people or Americans of color have endured in this country, certainly more so than some, you know, than perhaps even yourself. And I make that point to make. I'm glad you mentioned.
That was the point I was trying to make, by the way.
I'm glad you make the point of reparations as you did, because several things. First of all, when we're looking at reparations, do we include the cards of New Orleans, Louisiana, who had the most profitable slave plantation in the United States, in the history of the United States, which was black owned? Do we include Ellison of Virginia, who was a black slave breeder at the time white Southerners were opposed to slave breeding, and Ellison was not only a black slave breeder, but he was also a very prominent black businessman. Do we include the Irish who were slaves in New Jersey? And when you talk about the KKK and condemnable idea of how to keep blacks from voting, I'm quoting in part from words from Republican John Roy Lynch in 1872, when he said more colored than white men are thus persecuted simply because they constitute larger numbers the opposition to the Democratic Party. And then we have Richard Kane, a black Republican representative of South Carolina, 1872, who was also a bishop of the A&E denomination, saying the bad blood of the South comes because the Negroes are Republicans. If they would only cease to be Republicans and vote the straight-out Democrat ticket, there would be no trouble. Then bad blood would sink entirely out of sight. It was these Democrats and Klan inhuman outrages to which Republicans here object.
Yeah, I assume, Michael, that you're not trying to confuse modern people about the history of the Democratic and Republican parties. Because the fact of the matter is that the Democratic Party was the party of slavery and opposed civil rights right up until the 1950s and 1960s. And in 1872, you had the radical Republicans who pushed the Civil War, pushed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
That's not true.
And ultimately,
that's not true. You go back to 1856. When the Republicans
in Jackson, Michigan, when the party was founded,
when the Republican Party was founded in opposition to the Whigs, who were pro-slavery, and the Republicans said, "We will not stand with you." They fought it.
I'm familiar with the history. What does that have to do with right now?
what I'm saying, and I established that because you referenced the KKK and the corrosive verbiage that was employed. I mentioned that because we need to look forward. And talking about what has happened, my family were slaves. This is something that I'm quite familiar with.
Yeah.
And I don't hear this hatred, this vitriol, this you owe me. In America, why?
So Michael, we're out of time, and I'm sorry I don't control the brakes here, but we're just out of time. Net is, you oppose a commission to investigate reparations?
Absolutely.
Okay, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Michael-Massey.com, spelled, how do you spell it, Michael?
MICHAL-MASSIE.com.
Thank you very much, Michael. Good talking with you. Hey, just a reminder, and I'm going to mention this again in 5 minutes. We are trying something new on the TV show, and so if you have Skype and you would like to ask a question, a video question, that we will play back on the TV show tonight, and I will answer on the air, then call our Skype right now. Andrew and Nate are standing by to answer the Skype machine, and we'll be for the next 15 minutes. You got 15 minutes to do it, and give us a call at Talk to Tom. That's our Skype ID, TalkToThom. So that said, Brenda, watching Free Speech TV in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Brenda, what's up?
Hi.
Hey, Brenda.
Can you hear me?
Oh,
okay. I'm sorry. I didn't want to take you off my speakerphone.
Thank you.
Hang on one second. Sorry about that. Hi. Sorry about the dead air. Anyway, I just wanted to call because I am an independent. I was originally Republican from Orange County, California. And I re-registered as an independent. And then the whole Tea Party thing happened. I think a lot of people fled the Republican Party. So anyway, yeah. I tried re-registered as an independent, and I still felt like I wasn't getting any representation. So I started volunteering this year after listening to the radio, mostly Stephanie Miller, and got involved in local politics. And I'm working for the 48th District for Dr. Sue Savary. She's running against Dana Rohrabacher, and I re-registered as a Democrat in order to volunteer. And it was the most rewarding 3 hours I think I've had in 20 years.
Wow. Good on you. Yeah, Dana Rohrabacher is a pretty toxic guy. I mean, he's been around for a long time.
Oh, God, tell me about it. But, yeah. You know, I learned so much about, you know, I know you're a nationwide broadcast, but about California and the jungle primaries coming up and how only the top two make it.
Yep.
Et cetera. So it's just so important for people to go out and vote for your local politics because, I mean, people are getting elected that make appointments for commissions about school boards and real estate development and your taxes, minimum wages. I mean, I think that the Republicans are pretty much done nationwide for presidency, but everybody needs to get up and vote and get involved, whether you're Republican, Democrat, independent, and get involved in your local elections.
Yeah. Especially your local elections and get knowledgeable
and stuff.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Especially things like city council, school board.
Absolutely.
I mean, these are the points of entry now. The Koch brothers have now moved their strategy. I mean, they're still pursuing a national strategy, but now they're throwing additional money into literally school board races and county commissioner races and judgeships.
Exactly. And like, you know, I just learned when I volunteered last week that we have a big thing going on in Irvine, California with a private company that spent a bunch of money and, got a park. And so anyway, and then there's all these commissions that are open. And if you're interested in politics, you know, see what kind of commissions are open you could be appointed for. You don't have to have a degree in politics. Anybody can do it. But nobody even knows. I did learn there was like 600 or 700 positions open, vacancies just this year coming up. So
yeah, and occasionally some of them actually pay. I mean, a lot of them are voluntary, but if you're looking for a job, I mean, you know, go knock on the door of your local Democratic Party. There may be something you can do. Brenda, we're out of time, but thank you for the call, and good on you for your activism. I'm proud of you. Thank you so much for the call. Great to hear. We will be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. You have 10 minutes left. to call on Skype. Our Skype ID, TalkToTom, T-A-L-K-T-O-T-H-O-M, and ask a question, which we will play as a video question tonight on The Big Picture, on our TV show that's on Free Speech TV and RT TV. You have 10 minutes left if you want to do that. Andrew and Nate are standing by at the Skype machine to take your call if you have a question that you'd like to see on the air tonight in our Your Take, My Take live segment. So our Skype ID once more, if you have a Skype machine, Skype us with a question. And they're going to be there. They're going to be answering that machine until for another 8-9 minutes. Our Skype ID is TalkToTom, T-A-L-K-T-O-T-H-O-M. So just a heads up on that. Libby Carr in Washington State working on the Washington Amendment the statewide referendum or resolution or whatever you call it to say, yes, this state wants to be on record as saying that we should amend the Constitution to say money is not speech and corporations are not people. Hey, Libby, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, Tom. Thank you very much.
What's the latest on the campaign?
Well,
WAMEND.org, by the way. WAMEND.org.
Right. The latest is tomorrow is the beginning of Folk Life. It's the biggest folk festival in the country. It'll go on for 4 days, and we are in it through Ben Collins' good graces in the Stamp Stampede. He's one of the sponsors of Folk Life this year, which is a real amazing event. And as you know, you interviewed him this week. He's a real big supporter and came all the way out here from Vermont to work with us this week and focus a lot of attention on our initiative. And he's really helped. We've gotten a lot of press interviews and a lot of people calling. And we're really inviting everybody who lives in the state of Washington to come to Folk Life, sign the petition, learn to be a signature gatherer. It's real easy. And help us get on the ballot.
Great. Great. Okay. Libby, thank you very much. The website is WAMEND.org, WAMEND.org. If you're in Washington State, get over there right now and sign up and become a ballot, a signature gatherer or add your signature. And if you do not live in Washington State, you can still help out and you can find all the information there. And you could even start a similar one in your state. And good on you, Libby, for what you're doing. Thank you. Dave in Ellicott City, Maryland. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. The stick rock idea that guy called earlier with.
Excuse me?
You wanted to talk about the guy who called up and said that,
Yeah, Paul's comments a few minutes ago. He said he wasn't an engineer. Well, I have a master's in mechanical engineering. And his idea for the dropping rock and the stick and all that, good idea, workable idea, usable idea. As a matter of fact, it was invented in the 14th century. It's called a clock.
Oh yeah, with the lead weights and you pull the string.
And allows the dropping weight to drop slowly in a controlled manner, and rather than drive a generator, you're driving a clock.
Right.
And your idea of lifting the rod, your description of the exchange between potential and kinetic energy is absolutely correct. Because you know, there's going to be losses, frictional losses and such, and, you know, you raise the rock back up and you have to drop it again. You could use that as a means of storing energy.
Yes.
But if you're going to hook a windmill up to it, why not just hook the windmill up to the turbine?
Well, obviously, but I was trying to help him have some understanding of the fact that you can't get energy for nothing.
Right.
It's got to come from someplace.
Right, and people have been trying, and you can't get something for nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
Newton's first law of motion.
Good idea.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'd really like to see them do is take those oil subsidies away from the oil companies, because those were given to the oil companies in the beginning of the 20th century to get people to use oil. Well, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
You can take those subsidies, give those to the alternate sources, solar power, geothermal, wind power, all those kinds of things. Take it away from the oil companies, get people using that stuff. And get us the heck off oil.
And you would birth
That's
new industries
so
and create millions of new jobs and get us and cut out the funding for Al-Qaeda, and all kinds of cool stuff would come out of that. You're absolutely right, Dave. Dave, thanks for calling, and thanks for reminding me about how the old clocks work. You're absolutely right. I used to have one of those kind of clocks. David in Victorville, California. Hey, David, you want to talk about reparations?
Yes, Tom. And I would like to start off by saying, you know, that compassion deficiency
is not synonymous with white skin, nor what the guy was sharing with you, this Michael character, about reparations not being required because, you know, he did his research and found that there were black people that were engaged in the slave trade.
Right.
They were
the minority.
Well, they were the minorities, but then on the other hand, you go back to the continent, you had some, you know, Africans participating in that as well.
Sure.
So, but my point is this. Now, if we do the study and we can do it with a sense of human compassion and consideration, perhaps this will move the nation along healing that wound that has never been healed.
I agree.
Right now, Conyers' bill only want to do the study.
That's right.
Now, this compassion deficiency that seems to be epidemic nowadays, and it's spun on by a kind of belligerent ignorance and denial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think one of the ways to get at trying to heal this, to move us towards a more humane society, is the studying of this unvarnished.
Yeah, and it opens the conversation, too.
Yes, and it opens a conversation, and then the next question comes. I mean, after the study, is that, okay, if there were some Irish slaves, if there were any of the human...
Those Irish slaves that he mentioned were actually indentured. They were people who traded the rest of their life in basically slavery and indenture in exchange for passage from Ireland on a boat, and very often it was also for the pardoning of a crime that they had committed in Ireland. So I don't think it's really comparable with black slavery. But I get your point, David, that we need to be looking at all the slaves. I'm with you. Thank you very. I'm sorry we're out of time, but your point was really, really well made. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I wrote about this in one of my books, how Louise and I had flagstones in our house in Vermont that were made by Welsh slaves. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We can still do that, Danielle. Oh, you don't have the thoughts. Okay, so we can't do it. All right. It's no problem. Welcome back. We've been discussing, there's just actually a lot of things we've been discussing. Diane in San Jose, California, you wanted to talk about an earlier caller who was talking about housing, a vet who was basically at his wit's end. Diane? Okay, Diane's listening to her radio instead of her TV, instead of her phone. Don in Chicago. Hey, Don. Reparations? Don just dropped off the line. Well, that's interesting. I hope we're not having phone problems. Charles in Miami, Florida. Can you hear me, Charles?
I can, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. You're on the air.
Just a quickie. I was going to suggest that why don't we start calling the Republicans regressives, which is what they are. And just go ahead, you know, Karl Rove, obviously a brilliant political strategist, said that you need to be able to brand your candidate with a short, pithy statement that really describes them in a positive way if you're trying to win and negative way if you're trying to beat them.
Well, I think part of the problem is if 65% of Americans don't know which party controls Congress, probably an equal number of Americans don't know what the word regressive means. Maybe we should just call them shills for the billionaires. Or bigots, or, I mean, you know, there's a couple things that are, I think, fairly good descriptions.
Well, and I don't know how well they would float either, because their political consciousness doesn't tap into what these two statements that you just made. Well, you may be right, Tom. I disagree. I think if we call them regressives, I think a large percent of the population knows what progress is.
I know, you know, some of my colleagues call them Republicans and things like that. I just, you know, I've never been into calling people names. You know, it diminishes you know.
It's not so much a name as it is characterizing what they do.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're progressive, they are regressive. Actually, back in the 50s and 60s, conservatives were just saying, slow down. William F. Buckley, you know, he would constantly say, just slow down. That was the conservative position. Now they're actually saying, let's go back. Let's go back. In some cases, let's go back to before the Constitution. Let's go back to the Articles of Confederation, you know, when the states were...
Let's go back to feudalism.
Yeah, exactly. Well said, Charles. Well said. Well, let me think about that. Regressives. It's good to hear from you. Thank you. Diane in San Jose, you want to try it again? Diane? Diane isn't working. Don in Chicago, you want to try that one again?
Yeah, sorry about the disconnect.
It's quite all right.
Now?
Yeah, reparations?
Okay. So you were saying that white middle-class America has rung up a credit card bill for the slavery?
I'm saying all of America has, and which arguably includes black Americans. But their ancestors didn't run up a credit card bill the size that, you know, my ancestors, certainly on my mother's side of the family, ancestors ran up. They came over here in the late 1600s. And among my ancestors was a slaveholder, James Madison, you know, the third president of the United States, a fourth.
You're basically saying we've gotten certain dividends from it, right?
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it. So, I mean, you know, I can list them if you'd like.
There are probably certain groups that have gotten more dividends than others, but I don't know if I wouldn't say white middle class has gotten a lot of those dividends. But that's just a talking point. And the second one I wanted to say was, don't you think that things like affirmative action is sort of a reparations?
No, I don't. I think affirmative action was an attempt. Well, you could characterize it as a way to try to undo some of the more recent damage.
Based on race, right? And I personally think things like affirmative action should be based on income.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. I think that we are increasingly moving into, and this is a trend that is not yet really obvious to everybody, but mm-hmm. in 30 years, when the majority of people in the United States are people of color, it'll be obvious to everybody. We are increasingly moving into a society that is stratified not by race but by class. And we have been using race as a proxy for class for the last 400 years, but it's always been about class.
Yes, because race, I mean, it will follow the income a little bit, but really the income is the heart of the issue.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I don't disagree at all. But the fact of the matter is that some people are literally still suffering today because of what my ancestors, my mother's ancestors, did to their ancestors. And not just 400 years ago, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, but literally 40 years ago and this year. I mean, there are still, today as we speak, black people find it harder to get a job. They find it harder to get good housing. They find it harder to get health care. They have less economic wealth. They have less social capital as a consequence of all these years, leading right up to the modern era. And now we've got, you know, softer forms of bigotry, but they're just as harsh when it comes to things like access to health care, access to good education, access to good employment. They're just as harsh, well, not just as harsh, but they're very, very harsh. I mean, they're still there. They're still there. The banks no longer can legally redline. Jimmy Carter put an end to that. But the banks have figured out other ways to scam black people by and large, but also poor people. You're absolutely right. I mean, go to West Virginia. You'll see what we're all talking about. Don, thanks for the call. Diane in San Jose. I don't know. You keep popping up to the top of my board here. Danielle keeps moving you up to the top. She must think you're a really important call. What's up?
Okay. Can you hear me, Tom?
I hear you just fine.
Oh, good. Okay. Okay. A guy, Roger, I think his name is Roger. He's a vet, and he said he lost his job and his housing.
Yeah. And I told him to call his member of the House of Representatives constituent services person.
Okay. There are people, there are housing departments. Like there was one a piece of news in the Santa Fe Mercury News about 2 weeks ago. I don't know where this guy lives, but where they're giving housing vouchers to vets, it's a new thing. And I thought, well, you know, Bernie Sanders, I believe, is on that committee.
He's chairman of it in the Senate.
Yeah, he's chairman. So I was going to call Bernie And then because I know when you're homeless, I've never been homeless, but I know I could call Bernie and I could find out, or I could call HUD. I don't mind doing it because I work with homeless people.
Yeah.
I try to get two people into one place.
Well, Diane, I don't have that guy's contact information, but you know, he may still be listening, and I think you just
tomorrow's a free day, right?
Yeah. Tomorrow's anything goes Friday.
He's listening.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, if he's listening, I could say I talked to HUD or whatever.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, because they were giving.
If you want to poke around and do some research, Diane, I would love to hear back from you tomorrow on what you find out. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the call, Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was thinking about kind of a new, kinder, gentler, facilitative approach to talking with climate change deniers, which would kind of start like this. Okay, well, what would it look like if we were experiencing, catastrophic climate change? If this isn't it, then what? Because you see, when you're a denier, it presumes a certain amount of knowledge, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're right.
As soon as you know something, you say, no, this isn't it. What it would really look like would be, I guess, you know, so to find out what it is. And then also, how would you separate out man-caused climate change versus these natural cycles that we keep hearing about? Would they say, no, there's man can't cause it. It's impossible. Then you say, well, how do you know?
That's what this guy said last night, is that, you know, we're too small and too insignificant compared to the giant planet and God's creation. We're too small to influence something as massive as the weather system of the planet.
Well, that presumes that you know how big something would have to be in order to do that, right?
Yeah.
But
I mean, this guy made it as a categorical statement last night, you know, on my TV show, and I'm like, you know, how do you know that? And he's like, well, I just know that. It's like, you know, it's common sense. You know, we're little, and the climate is huge.
It's common sense. I think I've mentioned to you before the second epilogue in Moby Dick, where Melville talks about whether whaling is a good idea or not, and he essentially comes up with the same conclusion that, oh, no, God's ocean's too vast, his creature's too great. Right. We could never hunt them all down.
You're right.
That was in 1840-whatever, Moby Dick. By the end of his life, 50 years later, almost all of the sperm whales and right whales, which were the ones that were hunted, were almost all gone.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
brilliant point, Paul. I wish I'd remembered that last night. Thank you for calling and reminding me. And thanks for listening to KBCS. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Should we at least study the possibility of reparations? And might there be something in there for Native Americans also? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Kevin in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Kevin, you wanted to talk about Richard Mack and his Supreme Court case?
Hello, Tom. Good day.
Good day to you, Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah, in regards to yesterday's guest, Richard Mack, and I guess what is it, his sovereignty Supreme Court case, I would like to point out that local control almost killed Mother Jones with pneumonia during an illegal house arrest in Pennsylvania, as well as the state militia with private security did in fact murder and kill two women, 11 children, and 8 minors at the Ludlow Massacre.
Sure.
So, you know, that's all local control, so I don't understand how this guy thinks that we can get away with not having federal control. It took federal troops.
Well, the flip side of that is that, you know, the U.S. Constitution, federal control, empowered slavery in half the states.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
So I don't think that there's anything inherently good or bad about local versus federal control. I think that the question that we all have to answer, and this has been the big debate since the founding of the Republic, is what are the appropriate roles for each, and when is each most appropriately used?
I would agree with you, but one thing I would like to say is I sure would hate for us to have to you know, wait for another massacre to happen to, you know, reset those parameters between federal regulation and local regulation.
Yeah, well, there have been a lot of massacres since the local, since the Ludlow massacre. They just, you know, they're not as well publicized.
Oh, sure, definitely. And, you know, and they're also just externalized, as, you know, the externalized cost to having a corporation.
Oh, you know, sure. I mean, you could argue that, you know, the love canals of this country are massacres. You could argue that the Cancer Alley of Texas and Louisiana, downwind from the refineries, are, you know, is a massacre.
The L.A. harbors with all the cancer rates from the unfiltered smokestacks of the shipping coming across from Asia.
Yep.
And, you know, it all kind of ties right back to even reparations for slaves. I kind of would point out that, Tom, we're kind of assuming that we're out of slavery. You know, it kind of feels like economic slavery in the industrial commercial construction market.
We're certainly moving back toward feudalism. Yeah, we're certainly moving back toward feudalism. And in a feudal society, people are property. They're basically the property of their local king or lord. And in this case, people are increasingly becoming the property of their employers.
Exactly. And exactly the segue there is at Ludlow, Colorado, they didn't even get paid in American money. They were paid in corporate
script. Right, corporate script. Look at what Steve Jobs did. Look at what Steve Jobs did with Apple, where he conspired with the other big high-tech companies in Silicon Valley that they would not hire each other's employees because it would drive up wages. That is viewing your employees as property, not as people.
Oh, sure. And I've often wondered why that sector of our economy has always kind of really been proud of their independence and being free thinkers, I understand.
Oh, it's very libertarian to view people as property. It's very libertarian. Kevin, thank you for the call. If you don't know about that pretty disgusting piece of history that Steve Jobs was in the middle of, check it out. There have been a number of good stories written on it just in the last few months as it has come out as a result of some of these court cases. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Bob is also the author of Sideswiped, a book that if you want to know how Washington, D.C. works and you want to know the crimes that John Boehner committed, you really need to get and read. Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Tom?
I am well. So, Congressman, what's in the news today?
I think one of the top stories that just broke today is that the House has passed legislation, quote, to end the National Security Agency's bulk collection of American phone records. But I think that the words are to be watched of Democratic member Jan Schakowsky of Illinois, who said that it was, you know, watered down. And she said, we must not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I think that just means this is a start.
Didn't Justin Amash, the Republican from Michigan, who was one of the principal authors of this thing and one of the main, he's one of the few Republicans who's just on a warpath against the NSA, or not against the NSA per se. I mean, he's a big supporter of, you know, having a strong national security, but against the NSA snooping on all of us. Didn't he withdraw his support for his own piece of legislation, or did he go ahead and vote for it along with Jan Schakowsky saying, well, it's better than nothing?
You know, I don't know how he voted, and I apologize for that. I'm not sure how he voted on it.
That's quite all right. I'll have to track it down. I was just curious. It's just a point of curiosity. But it did pass the House. Do you think it's going to, you know, what do you think its fate's going to be in the Senate? You got, you know, Ron Wyden issued a statement this morning, I think it was. I got a press release in the email from his office. And as I recall, it said that Wyden felt that the bill was too watered down to be effective.
Oh, that's right. And also, after the whole fiasco of what happened with Senator Feinstein and the hacking of her computers, you know, et cetera, in recent times, because Senator Feinstein was pretty hawkish at one point in time on the issues.
And she was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee or the Defense Committee or something like that, something that had to do with the NSA.
The intelligence. But I think that the whole hacking of the computer, you know, her own computers made her look at this in a different manner. I think the Senate's going to make it a better bill for you know, civil liberties. That's what I think's going to happen.
Oh, that's interesting. And then they'll send it back to the House for reconciliation, and the House might go along with a better bill.
They may, because remember, you know, the House is not going to like it. I mean, they're at the beckoning call of, frankly, you know,
the defense contract.
Cheney, who were part and parcel to, you know, the beginnings of this entire thing. You know, they've been carrying out during this administration, but this is how it began.
Right.
And there's going to be a lot of the real neocon hawks who want confrontation around the world are willing to really put their feet down on this. But I think the Senate will make it a better bill.
Well,
at the end of the day, the Republicans would be fearful, I think, to kill it.
There's also hundreds of billions of dollars at stake here. I mean, an awful lot of these functions have been privatized, and you've got big corporations pouring millions, tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of dollars into the campaign coffers and political action committees super fund or whatever they are things, you know, to try to block this because they want their government contracts.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of money at stake. And plus, for a while, I mean, the attitude of a lot of the people, you know, they bought the line that we have to do this to stop the Osamas of the world. But what the United States has done is went, you know, so far out there. And I think one would point out, I don't know if anybody actually said this on the floor, but I don't think they would actually have brought a bill forth, Tom, and said, hey, we need to correct some real problems the NSA has unless Eric Snowden had, been the whistleblower that brought these facts out.
Yeah, Edward Snowden. But yeah.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Edward Snowden.
Yeah. What else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, I put a little note out on no letters for you. And I think this really, if I were the Democratic side, I would absolutely just, you know, go crazy on this thing. Congressman Issa, we all know who he is with the Government Reform Committee, you know, that's investigated everything under the sun. He has put out passed it, on an 18-13 party line vote with strictly Republicans as the 18. It has approved a proposal that would end door-to-door mail delivery for millions of Americans. And they would set up communal mail.
Why?
Because he's Darrell Issa, I guess. He thinks it's an efficient way to save money. Now, he's not mentioning who pays for communal mailboxes. How do you maintain communal mailboxes?
Well, typically the community does. I know because I live in a community that you used to live in, you know, down at the marina. And those mailboxes are paid for and maintained by the marina, are they not?
Well, they are. But I don't know how on earth in certain portions of America, especially particular in rural areas, you know, where there might be a house X amount of miles apart, and there's no real jurisdiction of government, I don't know how that is workable.
You know what this is about, Bob, is that the single largest unionized employer in the United States, the largest non-union employer, of course, is Walmart. The largest unionized employer in the United States is the post office. And that's why there has been this war on the post office since 2006 when they put that poison pill into the postal reform legislation requiring the post office to cough up $5 billion a year to prepay the health retirement benefits of postal retirees 75 years from now, people who haven't even been born yet. And that crippled the post office. And the whole goal is to destroy the single largest unionized employer in the country. And if they can end this, last mile delivery, they're going to be able to lay off lots and lots of mailmen and women.
Yes, because in 2006, that was almost the death knell with the pre-funding. You're right, for people that don't even exist yet.
Yeah.
And you have to look at this. If the Postal Service would be mandated to do this, it provides less service. If it provides less service, people won't frequent the post office as much, so it will lead to the virtual collapse of the post office.
Right. It's amazing to see something that
try to privatize it.
It's amazing to see something that Ben Franklin fought for and helped invent, that the founders and framers thought was important enough to write into Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution of the United States. And it's being systematically destroyed by Republicans simply because these are government employees with a union. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's un-American.
And, of course, it's coming from Congressman Issa, but he did pass it.
Yeah. Well, he passed it out of committee. So now it goes to the floor of the House. Is John Boehner going to bring it to a vote?
He may. And if I were the Democratic side, I would absolutely go crazy over this thing. A lot of people in America will relate to the negative on this bill.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you Bernie Sanders will filibuster it in the Senate. that ain't going to pass the Senate. There's no way. Bob Ney, his book is Sideswiped. You need to get it. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert Greenwald on the line with us, the founder and president of Brave New Films, bravenewfilms.org. Got a new movie out, Koch Brothers Exposed, while Koch Brother Mania is arriving at the Capitol. This is the 2014 edition. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you back with us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
It's been too long since we've talked. So,
sure. So
tell us about this new and improved Koch Brothers Exposed.
Well, the new version, which we launched on Tuesday with an event in Washington, D.C., where Senator Reid and Leader Pelosi were there and Senator Sanders, is an effort to reach millions of people who are being besieged by Koch-funded ads, attack ads, and all kinds of ads, and the way the Kochs fund think tanks. So what we've been able to do with the original film and now with this updated film is go out, investigate, find the truths about the Kochs, and then provide that information to people. And the wonderful news, Tom, is thanks to over 2,000 people who've given us contributions, we're able to make it available for free. So you can literally watch it for free, and then most importantly, send the link on to someone else you know who should see the film.
And what's the website for watching it for free?
Koch Brothers Exposed. That'll get you there.
Koch Brothers Exposed dot what?
.com.
.com. Okay. Koch Brothers, and Koch, of course, is spelled K-O-C-H, like Koch.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Koch Brothers Exposed, without the R. And so what, Robert, what, if in your mind, and you've seen the dark underbelly of the right-wing machine, what was the most surprising and interesting or shocking part of what you discovered when you were doing the research for this documentary?
Well, the original research, which I think was very important, what was most powerful is how smart they are with their funding. See, they don't just wait for the last minute and then fund some inane 30-second spot for a candidate that you have to hold your nose about. They start way back at the beginning, and they fund the ideas. They fund the think tanks. They fund grassroots organizations. They fund college activities. They fund pundits. And out of that comes the electoral process. It's an end as a result of all the work that they're doing. And one of the great quotes from one of the brothers was, "We discovered early on that politicians are like actors. They read from a script. And what we want to do is write the script." And that's what they're doing. They're writing that script.
One of them literally said that?
Yes.
Wow. Yes. Politicians are like actors. They read from a script, and we're going to provide them with the script.
Yep. And they're doing it. And they're doing it legally, and they're doing it effectively, and we're seeing how their message machine is having an extraordinary impact. And in the new film, Tom, we have quite a bit of new material, including the Koch's role in Citizen United. Here's a perfect example. The law, as it was pre-Citizens United, had the most limited controls, as we know, on funding.
Yeah,
but they didn't like
Feingold,
that.
Principally. Yeah.
Sorry?
McCain-Feingold and a few other of these, some remnants of the post-Nixon abuse of campaign finance laws you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. But they didn't like that. So they got involved. Seven different organizations that they fund became friends of the court in the Citizens United case. And they had two of the justices to their sort of secretive hidden retreats. And suddenly a new law. And now they're benefiting from the new law by spending hundreds of millions of dollars more.
Those two justices were Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, I assume?
Yes.
Isn't there some point, I mean, had Thomas or Scalia been federal judges in any court other than the Supreme Court, they could be in prison right now for that. I mean, that's a clear code of the violation of the Code of Federal Judicial Ethics. Maybe not in prison, but certainly lose their, you know, be impeached. I guess that's beyond the purview of Koch Brothers Exposed. It's basically how the Koch brothers are corrupting these guys. What can we do about this, Robert Greenwald?
Well, I think there's a lot we can do. And again, let's just remember, Tom, and of course you know this and many of your listeners do, that social change begins with social movements. It doesn't begin with a perfect or imperfect piece of legislation from the women's movement to the civil rights to the peace movement. And you've been active in all of those things, Tom. So what we can do as a first step is make clear to people the real import of dark money in politics, i.e. the Koch brothers. It's not abstract. It affects the job you can get. It affects minimum wage, which they're fighting, by the way. One of the most extraordinary figures we came up with is, listen to this, what the Koch brothers would make in 1 hour, a minimum wage worker would have to work 76 years full time.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's the kind of information and we have personal stories in the film. So the first, and I think the job that we all can do is help spread the word. Right. And again, the film is free. And not only that, you can send individual sections of the film. So let's say you know an environmentalist and their thing is only the environment. You can forward that section. If it's unions, a union section, if it's minimum wage, a minimum wage section, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're really excited to be able to unleash the digital tools so that everyone can do something.
That is superlative. That's extraordinary, Robert. We're talking
about exciting.
Robert Greenwald, activist, filmmaker, president of Brave New Films, bravenewfilms.org, about his new project, Koch Brothers Exposed.com. And does it hearten you that Harry Reid has actually taken these guys on the floor of the Senate now?
I think it's been great. I mean, Reid has been fierce on this issue, and it has also made him stronger and stronger on supporting the constitutional amendment. And, you know, when you talk to politicians in D.C., and generally, of course, this is off the record, and even Republicans, they get up every day, and how many hours a day do they spend just begging for money? Yeah. Nobody can, or almost nobody can enjoy that on a human level, policy aside. So I may be naive, but I am actually hopeful that this will begin to really affect elected officials when they see maybe there are other ways to work.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. I did a TED talk on this TEDx talk on this a couple of weeks ago in Portland. On this topic of Citizens United, and my call for action, of course, was amend the Constitution to say that money isn't speech, and therefore is not protected by the First Amendment. George Washington did not fight the Revolutionary War to protect the billionaires, and corporations are not persons, and therefore are not protected by the 14th Amendment. Abraham Lincoln didn't fight the Civil War to free the corporations. And after I was done, it hit me that the one thing I'd forgotten to say, and I'm slapping myself upside the head for it, was that it's not going to be that hard to get this amendment through Congress, because I have talked with Republicans as well as Democrats, like you said, off the record, who say, I hate the fact that I have to spend 5-6 hours a day. You know, there's probably 50 of them who have offices in this building that we're sitting in that I'm sitting in right now, because we're just two blocks away from the Hart Center office building. That they have to go off premises for 4 or 5 hours a day and dial for dollars and beg people for money. They hate it.
Right. And I think that's very important. And I think you mix that, Tom, with the fact that no matter what your issue is and no matter on which side of the issue you are, unless you're 1% or unless you're a billionaire, you know that your issue is being screwed over in the sense that it is being bought. It's being legally bought.
That's right. We saw this new study that just came out of, I think it was Princeton, that indicated that, you know, if the 1% wanted something, it probably happened legislatively over the last 10 years, or the last 18 years, actually, they looked at. And if the 50% of the median wanted something, no such thing. Robert Greenwald, hang on just a second, Robert. I'm going to get stepped on. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Robert Greenwald, president and founder of Brave New Films, bravenewfilms.org. More importantly, KochBrothersExposed.com. Check it out. Thank you, Robert.
My pleasure.
And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Lewis in South Plainfield, New Jersey, listening on WBAI. Hey, Lewis, you wanted to get back to affirmative action?
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's nice to talk to you. I just wanted to make a point. One of your previous callers talked about how affirmative action should basically adapt to income inequality today.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're going back to income inequality, I think that just shows the how the government is basically failing us to begin with. So we can't, you know, basically maybe adapt laws to, like, cover up for their mistakes. And to go back on how affirmative action is basically, you know, it basically works out better for you know, give other races, you know, an opportunity, you know, get a job or whatever. I don't really want to go back to the Donald Sterling thing, but, you know, if you know, there's a boss who, you know, might not hire you for, you know, maybe being black or Hispanic. But say in a thing like this, where you know, they made a big deal out of it because, you know, the conversation got leaked. But, you know, for the average man, you know, this incident would never happen. So I think laws of, like, affirmative action, you know, prevent from someone from being hired simply because of their race. And yeah, that was basically my point. I don't think I'm really gonna add it.
Well, affirmative action goes a little beyond that. It actually gives you a bit of a small edge. And it probably the most, in at least in college, and the Supreme Court struck down the State University of Michigan's affirmative action program, its race-based affirmative action program. What they didn't strike down is the University of Michigan's wealth-based affirmative action program. If your parents went to that college, or if your parents are donors to that college, then you're far more likely to get in because of these, quote, legacy programs, which is an affirmative action program for having ancestors who attended the college, which in almost all cases is going to mean white, in the vast majority of cases, it's going to mean white ancestors. That program was not struck down by the Supreme Court. Those programs are still intact. So, but affirmative action is about giving people an edge. It's not necessarily entirely about fixing things. I look at, I have a couple of friends who are Native Americans, and one of them worked very, very hard to prove that he had a certain percentage of Native American blood so that he would qualify for a BIA, a Bureau of Indian Affairs card, that would give him access in his tribe to federally paid for medical services and certain other benefits that were associated with being a member of the tribe. And in some tribes, those benefits even include things like, you know, if the tribe is a wealthy tribe, and there are a few that, you know, run casinos or have natural resource concessions, where you'd actually share in the wealth of the tribe. And so, you know, it's kind of the reverse of what was being done in the United States back, you know, when the Constitution was written, which is, you know, how much blood does it take for someone to be defined as an African-American, or what they used to refer to as a mulatto, somebody who's, you know, what percentage? I think it worked out as, what is it, 1/8? You know, 1/16, I don't remember the exact part, but of blood, and you were, you know, no longer considered an American, a white person or an American citizen. And this is why I think John Conyers' commission to study this is so important. You have to figure out who and how and how you're going to do it, and who qualifies. And Lewis, you raised some important questions. Thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WBAI. We'll be back. Thursday. Let's let's get geeky on getting healthy. We've known for a while that fattening and unhealthy foods are contributing to the obesity epidemic that's currently gripping America. But scientists have now discovered that it's not just fattening and unhealthy foods that are the problem. It's cheap foods. Researchers looked at all the possible causes for obesity, from available foods to increased use of cars to more time playing video games. And they found that cheap foods and their wide availability are possibly the main culprit behind the obesity epidemic. Right now, food is cheaper than it has been at any time in history, which means Americans are consuming more of it. And unfortunately, since unhealthy food is typically less expensive to begin with, today it's even cheaper. Just look at fast food burger chains like McDonald's and Burger King that have greatly increased the number of offerings on their dollar menus. You can walk into a McDonald's today and get a greasy, artery-clogging triple cheeseburger for just a buck. In a press release in their study, researchers said that, quote, Americans are spending a smaller share of their income on food than any other society in history or anywhere else in the world, yet get more out of it. Examining time trends for which there are data, what jumps out are changes in food availability, in particular, the increase in caloric sweeteners and carbohydrates. Here's the thing, though. America is the richest country in the world. We should be embarrassed that anyone has to resort to eating cheap and therefore unhealthy food simply because they can't afford the proper nutrition that they need. We need to be establishing policies and programs that combat poverty in America and that allow Americans to buy healthier foods. The correlation between poverty and higher obesity rates is undeniable. So let's start doing more to fight poverty in our country and in the process make America a lot healthier. Well, that's an interesting idea. It's an excellent idea. Maria in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Maria, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. My subject is racial discrimination.
Uh-huh.
And I want to say that I get really exasperated because racial discrimination, is when it's mentioned, it's only about blacks. And yes, they have been discriminated against, and they are discriminated against now. But why aren't Hispanics ever mentioned?
Because well, I was not talking about discrimination. I was talking about slavery. And there have been Hispanics who have been slaves, but there was not an institutional enslavement outside of Christopher Columbus did. There has not been an institution, and that was Native Americans in the Caribbean islands, in what is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic. There has not been, correct me if I'm wrong, an institutional enslavement of Hispanics.
But we have been discriminated against.
Absolutely.
I mean, just like the blacks, we are discriminated against.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so I don't understand why just the blacks are mentioned. I mean, I don't mind that they are mentioned because, yes, it is discrimination. You know, there has been discrimination against them, but also against us. But I don't see why Hispanics aren't mentioned.
Or Native Americans. Let me just be very clear about this. There's two separate conversations here. One is a conversation about paying back a group of people who for 300 or 400 years gave us literally their lives, their bodies, everything they had because they were slaves. That's the reparations discussion.
We have two. We worked. We have two.
Okay.
We worked on the railroads. We worked building roads. We worked just like the blacks did. We were right there doing the same things that the blacks did. So I don't understand.
Okay. And then the second conversation is the conversation about how institutionally both the white power structure in this country at the level of government and the white power structure in this country at the level of corporate power has historically discriminated against and thus marginalized, minimized, disempowered, disenfranchised, and impoverished Latinos, African Americans. There was a time in this country when there was aggressive. There's still discrimination against Asians, but it was very aggressive. In fact, the only law that has ever been passed by Congress specifically to discriminate against a race of people was in the 1880s. To forbid the importation of people from China to work on the railroads to bust the unions. Yes. So, yes. So yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, Maria. Your point is well made. And I think that if we're having a conversation about ending discrimination or affirmative action, even reversing the consequences of discrimination, it has to include Native Americans, it has to include Hispanics, it has to include Asian Americans, and it has to include women. Women were the property of men until the 1920, and even in many ways to this day are. And I mean, you know, look at the consequences in so many cases of divorce cases and women making 70% of what men make in the workplace and what's her name who just got fired from the New York Times, et cetera. So all of these are strong cases for some sort of affirmative action program. But actual reparations, you know, for 20 generations, your family literally were the property of white people. Therefore, we owe you something. That's largely
never mentioned. Never, I have never heard that
in the context of Hispanics. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the concept of discrimination.
Right.
I think that
discrimination and reparations are two separate issues. I think, you know, reparations are paying back for what was done. Affirmative action is trying to pay back against discrimination, but discrimination is not enslavement. There's a difference. I mean, they're both evils, but enslavement is a very different type of evil. And then there's the Holocaust that happened against Native Americans. I mean, you know, the wholesale slaughter of Native Americans. And in Central and South America, there's the wholesale slaughter of Native Central and South Americans, people that we would now call Hispanic in North America. The slaughter of your people by the Spaniards, by and large, and then the French and the English. Maria, thank you for the call. It's thought-provoking. Good stuff. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, should we consider reparations? And if so, how? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, this is interesting. Jack Coleman, a recovering former liberal journalist from Massachusetts, has a blog over at newsbusters.org. And he quotes me from a little kind of rambling riff that I did on May 16th, in which I was talking about I'll tell you the business. Back in 1983, Louise and I started a business in Atlanta, Georgia. It was called International Wholesale Travel, Inc. And we did business as Sprayberry Travel and as there was also a cruise business. I forget the name of it, which we didn't really ever do much with. But Sprayberry Travel did really well. And we started this was kind of in the wake of a lot of changes in the travel industry, shall we say. And we started the nation's first frequent flyer program for customers of a travel agency. In 83. And by 84, it was growing really rapidly. We paid our employees well. Our employees were mostly childbearing age women who had kids. These were the people who were by and large travel agents back then. I don't know about today. Haven't really checked in with the industry in a few decades. And by 85, we paid well. We ran our own daycare center, so that we could provide free daycare for our employees so that they could, you know, be with their kids. And it was a good business. And at some point, Louise and I mean, that kind of the history of our life has been that, you know, every 5 or 10 years, we'd start a business, build it up, sell it off, take a couple of years off, and then go back and start something else. And what we had started before this business was a community for abused children that we started in 1978 in New Hampshire. The Hunter School, the Salem Children's Village, hunterschool.org, salemchildrensvillage.org. You can see the websites. We started that in 78, and we stayed there until 83. And then in 83, we moved to Atlanta, and we were basically out of money. You know, we had sold a business in 78 in Michigan, the Woodley Erber Company and American Marketing Centers. And with that, you know, with the money that we got from that, we started the Community for Abused Kids. And then we kind of burned through that, taking $25 a week for 5 years. We were broke. So with using my 10 or 15,000, I don't remember which. I think it was $10,000 line of credit from American Express. And with a couple of partners, we started this little travel agency in Atlanta. It did really well. And in fact, by the third year, we had applied some pretty good marketing principles to what we were doing. I was teaching other travel agencies how to do this. A couple of cruise lines, Carnival and Crown, had hired me to go on ships and teach travel agents how to make the travel agencies successful, writing articles for industry publications. And we decided to sell the company and move to Europe and take a year off and put our kids in the German public school and live at this international charity that we had been volunteering our time for since 1978. SalemInternational.org is that, if you want to check that out. And which we did. We moved to Germany June of 86. And I pointed out on the air that we had really planned on doing it a few years later, and we probably should have in retrospect. So from the time we sold that agency, it was doing about $6 million a year when we sold it, and it's done over $250 million, over $250 million a year in business since we sold it, and it recently merged with last year or the year before. I talked about it on the air, there was a little news ticker story that came across, merged with a multi-billion-dollar travel agency. And so had we just kept that company and kept running it, I'd probably be very wealthy right now. But in any case, in 86, back in 81, Reagan had dropped the top capital gains rate down to 20%, which was insanely low. I mean, it's back Herbert Hoover territory. And in 81 and in 86, he was raising it back up to 28%. And so, you know, our CPA said, you know, if you're going to sell this business, you should sell it now and get the old capital gains rate, the 20% rate, rather than sell it later and pay 28%. And that would have meant, you know, a fair amount of money, as I said on the air, tens of thousands of dollars for Louise and I. We weren't talking about gazillions. We weren't the Koch brothers or anything like that. But it was still, to us, a lot of money. And so we sold the company in 86. And somehow Jack Coleman thinks that, well, the headline is, did Reagan hater Tom Hartman benefit from Reagan tax cut? Arguably, yes, because I was a business owner. But that was my whole point. The class of business owners benefited from the Reagan tax cuts. It was, you know, at that point, I was one of the rich people. I mean, we walked away with enough money that we could live in Europe for a year with three kids and then come back to the United States and start a brand new business from scratch, which we did in 87. We moved back to Atlanta and we started an advertising agency. So A, and B, and perhaps more importantly, had that capital gains tax not been being jacked around up, down, whichever way, had it always been at, say, 50%, I'd probably still own that company. It would not have made flipping companies a useful thing, whether it's for entrepreneurs or whether it was for, you know, who's the guy who went after TWA, you know, some of these, you know, or the Mitt Romneys of the world. I mean, you know, whatever. And I think, you know, people holding companies is a good and valuable thing, you know, keeping them in their family. We just don't have family-owned businesses in America anymore. Yeah, Carl Icahn, yeah. I mean, you know, and he was all over this kind of stuff around that time. And whenever the capital gains tax would change, you know, he would be buying or selling a business. And so I think, Jack, you're making my point. And thank you for making it over at newsbusters.org. And hopefully some people will figure this out, you know, that, yeah, the Reagan tax cuts help rich people like I was then, or the ownership class, shall we say, the employer class, and they didn't do much for my employees at all. I mean, you know, we just took the money and ran. And in fact, I believe, I could be wrong, but I would be surprised. Let me put it this way. I would be surprised if the multi-billion dollar travel agency that now owns Sprayberry Travel, the company that Louise and I started, still offers the benefits that we did when we owned it. We had full health insurance for our employees, which we paid 100% of. We had in-house daycare, which we paid 100% of. We brought in food a lot of the time. We paid for a lot of people's meals. We paid above the industry average because we wanted people who would stay with us for years, and we did. I mean, we only owned the business for 3.5 years from the time we started until the time we sold it. But when we sold it, at least half of our employees were the people that we started it with. So I doubt that that's the case now that it's part of a giant conglomerate. I would bet that the benefits have been cut, the wages have been cut, the daycare is long gone. So, Jack, thanks for making my point. Anyhow, all that said, Steve in Chicago, you wanted to talk about reparations. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, a couple of points, if I might. An earlier caller raised this question about, you know, this sort of, you know, what about my group? And that is actually a central point in terms of getting reparations passed through any sort of legislation. And there are a number of obstacles. One, there is this question that is a cornerstone of our legal system, such that, you know, you cannot punish someone or an institution for doing something that was not against the law at the time the act was committed.
Right. These are called ex post facto laws. Yeah.
Exactly.
But that doesn't prevent ex post facto reparations. That's not explicitly. You cannot penalize somebody ex post facto. You can reward somebody ex post facto, and we have a long history of having done that to people who have.
But that's under very different circumstances. I mean, for instance, the relationship between the United States and Native American tribes, those treaties. There was no treaty that prohibited slavery, so that doesn't apply.
What about, you know, Asian Americans being interred in the Japanese internment in World War II?
Completely different situation. Again, a violation, clear-cut violation.
Right, so we have this unique situation of slavery. What do we do about it?
Right, and you're absolutely correct, because this is one of these issues wherein you can absolutely make the case for the justification of reparations. However, then you begin down a road of, okay, the devil is in the details, because as soon as you say, well, it's analogous to having five people in a car of different ethnic, racial, gender groups, and so forth, and we're hit by this large entity, hypothetical entity. One person died, another person's crippled for life, other people are injured more so, some less. We don't simply say that we're going to pay out money to the person who died or the person who was handicapped.
Actually, a jury could do that. But Jack, my point was that if we just did what John Conyers is asking for and started a commission, I think a lot of people would get the horrors of slavery in a way that they don't have right now. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think people would get it. I think it would elevate the discussion, and I think it might start minimizing some of the racism that's still ongoing in our society, institutional and otherwise. Steve, thanks for the call. And welcome back. Shane just made an excellent point. He said, you know, it might actually make things worse. Because you'd get a bunch of white people who are going, hey, how come I'm not getting anything? You know, just like affirmative action really stirred up some folks. So, I don't know, it's an interesting one. Ta Tanisha in Detroit. Hey, what's up?
Hi. I was listening to the Hispanic woman that called in, and it was so much stuff wrong with what she was saying, but the one point I wanted to make about what about us? As if she made it seem like as if the Hispanic struggle was equal to the black struggle. And what everyone must realize, and what I want you to say next time someone says that, is that we did not ask to come here. Her ancestors came here voluntarily. Blacks did not ask to come here. And so that is, therein lies the big difference.
That's an important point.
That is a very important point that they must, you cannot forget. She made it seem like, oh, well, they built the country with us. No, you didn't. When I trace my ancestors back, I can go as far back as my great-great-grandmother who lived in Memphis. She can go back to Cuba. Mexico, Puerto Rico, Dominican, and actually go literally there and live. I cannot go back to Africa. This is my country because they brought me here. And my struggle is not the same as hers. That's all I'm saying. There is discrimination. I hate all discrimination. I see the discrimination between blacks and Hispanics, but it is just not the same, and it should not be viewed that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's why I kept trying to say there are two conversations here. One conversation is about discrimination, and we can talk about discrimination against Hispanics, against Native Americans, against Asians, against blacks, whatever you want. We need to do something about discrimination, and there are remedies, specific remedies for that. There's a whole nother conversation about reparations, and A, reparations for slavery, and B, and this is a conversation that nobody ever brings up, and that is reparations for the Holocaust, for the genocide against Native Americans.
Right.
The people who were here first.
Right. And I heard all of this stuff you were saying. I was with you until she said, you know, we built the railroads right next to them. No, you didn't. Yeah. We made the dirt flat. You know, my people are under there. We swung from trees. You didn't have to do that. You can't go back and say that happened to you. You can't look at what's going on now in America and directly tie it back to slavery. Your people came here voluntarily, and they can actually leave.
Yeah. Yeah, slavery is an original sin that is monstrous in its proportions. And it's been gone for over 100 years, and it continues to influence America. It's mind-boggling.
Yes, I really just wanted to say that. I'm a first-time caller. I enjoy everything you say. That's the first time after listening to all the Republicans, that's the first time my hair caught on fire.
Yeah, okay.
So, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for calling and for being passionate enough to share your thoughts and so well said with all of the rest of our viewers. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. It's Tom Harbin with you. We have about 8 minutes left in the show today, and if I'm on the right hour, I am. And I've got a board full of calls, and so I'm going to ask everybody to try and keep your comments to a minute or less. How about that? And let's see how many calls we can get in. Robert in Santa Maria, California. Robert, about race relations?
Oh, well, first off, congratulations on extending your hours. You're actually extending them for us.
Yeah.
Because we enjoy learning what in the heck's going on through your program.
Well, thank you, Robert.
And secondly, there is a book by a Reverend Frederick J. Price in Los Angeles, a preacher who had a 220,000 person church, who wrote a book called Race, Religion, and Racism. I really recommend you to read that. It will blow your mind.
Okay.
He has gone back through history. I know it's if the rest of people could read it, they would realize where the racism comes from.
Yeah.
Which I traced back to the...
Robert, I appreciate it. I'll take a look at it. Let me toss something back at you. In the current issue of The Atlantic, theatlantic.com, there's an article by Ta-Nehisi Coates titled The Case for Reparations, which is what got me started on all this thing. I would strongly encourage you to check that out, back at you. Robert, thank you for the call. Charles in Glenwood, Illinois. Charles?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
Good. What's up?
3 points I want to make real quick. As far as the caller that was the Hispanic that was talking about the black people and she's tired of hearing just about black people in slavery, I'm going to put a historical note out here. The very same year that Emmett Till was killed for, quote-unquote, whistling at a white woman,
right,
Lucille Ball was on television with a Cuban husband.
Right.
That's all I got to say about that part.
Yeah.
The second part is as far as how deep slavery is going, like what's going on with the voting issue in North Carolina,
mm-hmm,
I would like to make a proposal that I wish to be spread across the nation. In all states where they are trying to suppress the votes, by having minimum machines, have the people get in alphabetical order outside the polling place as they come. Have their IDs and their voter registration cards in their hands so that when they get inside the building, it's easier for them to find them.
We just need to extend voting days, extend voting hours, make it easier to have a hot national holiday for voting, do more voting by mail. Charles, I'm with you. Yeah. Thank you for the call. Good suggestions. Michael in Newberry, South Carolina. I'm moving faster here. Michael in Newberry, South Carolina. What's up, Michael?
Hello, Tom. It's Liberal in South Carolina. About the gravity to produce energy, you mm-hmm. covered that last week. A news item about the Spanish island that is 100% renewable energy.
Right.
They use windmills to power, to pump water uphill, and gravity to generate electricity when the wind ain't blowing.
Right, and they're doing the
you
same.
You already covered that.
Yeah, and they're doing the same thing in Norway, only they, you know, it's the turbo power from the, from, you know, the electricity is generated from water power. They're using it to pump up as storage. A good point, Michael. Thank you very much. Mac in Heber City, Utah. Hey, Mac, what's up?
Oh, Tom.
Yeah.
Hi. I had a quick anecdote about global warming.
Okay.
If you turn on a car in your garage and you let it run long enough, it'll kill you. If you Chrysler sold 80,000 Jeeps in April. So eventually, you know, there's going to be enough cars on the planet, you know, that I don't know how you would use that in an argument.
Oh, to kill us all? Because
yeah.
The atmosphere is only 5 miles high. Interesting point, Mac. Thanks a lot for calling and sharing it. Gordon in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Gordon.
Yeah, Tom, you were talking about that gal making the case for Hispanics being discriminated against a little earlier. And then you made the case for women at some point being discriminated against.
Yes,
something
to this day.
Something in what you said made me think of a John Lennon song, and I don't remember the title of the song, but the gist of the lyrics are, woman is the N-word of the world.
Ah, yeah, yeah. I think particularly in his later years, John Lennon got it. You know, when he was a youngster, he was a little wild and crazy. But excellent point. Thank you, Gordon, for that. Mike in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I wanted to comment about the lady that called in about reparations. I think she was wrong in what she said, because it's like another caller that refuted her comment earlier said that they didn't do all this stuff when she claims that they did alongside blacks. They weren't forcefully enslaved. They weren't separated from their families forcefully.
Yeah.
They weren't sold. They weren't killed. They weren't.
Yeah, this is what Tataisha said earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. And as a black man that was born and raised in a Latin American country, I can tell you it's unfortunate, but there is some racism amongst blacks and Hispanics, like Hillary Clinton said when she ran against Barack Obama.
Yeah.
It's sad, but it's true.
Yeah. It is, and it happens in every aspect of society, and this is why we need to be talking about it.
Right. And as far as reparations, how about some real reparations, and not in the monetary form, but in the form of compensating with real education and real opportunity? That's a good form of reparations.
Wow. You know, reparations as, yeah, you can go to school for free. You can get the government will be the employer of last resort for free. I mean, this is, I have been pushing this for so long. You know, Franklin Roosevelt did this. He said, the best welfare program is a job. Let's turn the government into the employer of last resort. Mike, brilliant. Thank you. Thank you for calling and sharing with us. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday, and that means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here talking about all the important issues of the week and taking your calls, too. Plus, anything goes Friday. You choose the topics we talk about. What's on your mind? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag your it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.